Okay, we're going to get started. So today's student talks and our speakers are going to be Maggie Miller, Corey Howell, and Dean Menezes. And so if you have questions, save them towards the end because we're kind of tight on time. So I guess let's welcome Maggie. Okay.
So I'm going to talk about network bisection. So I'm going to explain what it is, kind of explain a popular method of doing it, and then I'm going to talk about a method that I developed at my REU last summer, and we're still working on like writing a formal paper proving that it's correct. So network bisection, I think most of you have seen graph theory before, and if so, I'm going to use graph and network interchangeably. But a graph or network, it can be thought of as a system of vertices or points embedded in space. And they're connected by some system of edges, which are just lines that connect the vertices. And so this can represent real-world data. Like, imagine that you have a computer with two processors, and so it doesn't make sense to run like all of your operations through one processor because it defeats the whole purpose. And so if we want to split up a large task, it makes sense to like assign roughly, like if these each of these vertices are one operation that needs to be performed, and they're connected when there needs to be communication between your two processors if they're split up. It makes sense to cut it in a way that you kind of split the operations equally in half, but you also want to cut as few edges as possible because that's expensive when your processors have to talk amongst themselves. And then it also has applications in social sciences, like if this were to represent like a system of users on Facebook or something, where each vertex is one person and they're connected if they're friends. A sociologist might be interested in like partitioning people, like do people make friends based on ethnicity or age or gender? Somebody actually did this with dolphins in Doubtful Sound, New Zealand, and it's really interesting. But the problem is like, how do we like qualify what a good partition is? Like I can look at this and say like, this is a pretty good partition. I only cut one edge. I have about the same number of vertices on either side. But it's really hard to tell a computer to do that, especially once you get like really big systems. And so at first, people felt like the best way is let's just minimize the number of edges we cut and we'll always get the best partition. And that does work really well, but it's not always true. Like imagine our network actually looked more like this. Okay, so this is still the best partition, like intuitively, it looks the best, but if we're just gonna cut the least number of edges possible, I'm gonna cut it like here. And that's not interesting. Like, if I'm splitting this among my processors, I'm still basically doing all of the work with one, and it's not helpful. It's not going any faster. And so another popular method is to maximize something called modularity, which is where I generate a random graph. So I have to keep the same number of vertices, and each vertex has to have the same number of edges connected to it. But I'm going to let them be connected anywhere as long as I satisfy those constraints. And so, on average, how many edges would I expect to be between two vertices? And then, if it's higher, then I would expect they're well connected, and if it's lower, I'd expect then they're not well connected. And that works really well. It's not very fast, and there's like a resolution limit. So, along with another undergraduate, we tried to develop one where we would maximize something called efficiency in each cluster. And so that's where I'm going to define vertex efficiency. I say there's two vertices in my graph, V1 and V2. And I'm going to say that the efficiency between these two vertices is the reciprocal of the distance, where by distance I mean the least number of edges I would have to cross to get between them. So I think in this case I have to cross at least three edges. So the efficiency is 1/3. And so to make it easier to keep track of my efficiencies, I build an efficiency matrix whose ijth entry is just the efficiency between vertices I and j. All right, and so that means if I want to maximize the efficiency combined of both halves of my graph, I want to maximize this sum of all of the efficiencies times the delta function, where this is going to be 1 if the vertices are separated and they're put in the same half, and 0 if they're put in opposite halves of the graph. But then I still want to reward my graph for having fairly equal partitions. Like, I don't want to isolate one vertex. And so I have a reward function. So like the number of vertices in the left half, the number of vertices in the right half, divided by their sum. So this is going to be largest when they're approximately equal size, right? I'm just going to call this term R. And I can label my partition. I haven't chosen it yet. But once I have, I'm going to label it by this index vector, which is just defined to be ith entry plus 1 if the I is in the left half, and minus 1 if the I is in the right half. So just a vector, column vector. And so, conveniently, I notice that I can replace this delta term. When I multiply Si and Sj, I'm going to get minus 1 if they're on opposite sides. So that means Si, Sj plus 1 will be equal to 0 if they're on opposite sides. If they're on the same sides, this is going to be 2. So if I divide by 2, I just get exactly my delta function back. This is nice because now I've written it in a way where this sum directly depends on my choice of partition. Choosing S is the same as choosing a partition. And so now I have like a real thing that I can try to maximize. And it's also nice because I can rewrite this if I pull out my R over 2. I get SE, S transpose, plus the sum of all my efficiencies again. But this term is a constant. It didn't depend on my partition. I had already built that matrix that already exists. So I don't care about it. R isn't a constant. It does depend on the partition. But that's hard to maximize, like, without knowing more about my graph. Because, I mean, it doesn't really tell me anything about, like, how well connected it is. So I'll come back to it later. And right now I'm just going to focus on, maximizing S transpose ES. All right. And so now it's become just like a regular linear algebra problem. We've got away from the visual representation of the graph entirely, which is really great because we're just working with computers. I'm not going to draw a giant graph every time. That was my partner's idea. Okay, so luckily, E is a symmetric matrix because if I can go from V1 to V2, I can take the exact same path from V2 to V1. This isn't a directed network. And moreover, we're assuming that it's a connected network. So the efficiency between two vertices, like if they're not different vertices, sorry, if they're not the same vertex, can't be zero. Like it can be small, but it can't be zero. So we have a positive definite symmetric matrix with only, like it has zeros on the diagonal, but it's still irreducible. So that means that it's going to have a system of orthonormal eigenvectors, right? So I can choose eigenvectors U1 through UN normalized orthonormal for E. Which means that I can write S as just the sum UI transpose UIS. Just because, I mean, they're orthonormal, so they all cancel out. It's fine. And then E is going to be diagonalizable. Where I get U1 through UN. And U1 through UN transpose. And then here I have eigenvalues in the usual way. I've ordered these so that lambda I is going to be less than or equal to lambda I plus 1 for all I. So I'm just going to go in order. And so that means that when I literally write out SE, S transpose, S transpose ES, it's going to be something gross, but it's not that bad. Sum UI transpose S UI transpose. I have my E term, right? And then the sum, same thing. But the great thing is, these are orthonormal. So this product here, like along with the sum, is literally just going to get me the row vector U1 transpose S, UN transpose S. Right? Because like, you know, this product with this, I just get like a 1 in the first coordinate, and then I sum, and I get like a 1 in the second coordinate the second time. I have my eigenvalues. And then this second part, this product with the UI column vector is going to get me the same thing, but I'm going to have a column, so U1 transpose S. Sorry for my handwriting. Okay, So I'm literally going to get that S transpose ES is just the sum of scalar terms multiplied by my eigenvalues. And I can find the eigenvectors of a matrix really easily. Like, that's not a problem. I'm not worried about that. So if I want to maximize this, my natural choice is to like focus on the largest eigenvalue, lambda n, and choose my s to be like as parallel as possible to un, which would be choosing to have like a plus one in the entries where u sub I was had positive entries and a minus one otherwise. But the problem is that because E is a symmetric positive matrix, that first eigenvector is going to have all positive or negative signs, which is intuitively good because that corresponds to not cutting my graph at all. And if we are maximizing efficiency, that's kind of what I would want my algorithm to say, because when we're cutting edges, we're inherently going to lose efficiency. It doesn't make sense. But I don't like that option because that's even less interesting. And so I throw it away. And this is how I kind of justify not talking about R before, because I'm moving on to the second eigenvector, and it has to be orthogonal to the first eigenvector. And so it's true that the signs of terms could only vary in a few terms, but once we have like a really large graph, the probability of our two first eigenvectors only like varying in signs in a few places is really unlikely. I don't want to write it out right now, but it is. And so we can kind of justify not thinking about R by saying, like, oh, we're kind of already saying that we're not going to cut off a few, so let's just not even worry about R. Like, we've taken care of some kind of reward function. And so we choose our S back at the beginning. Instead of just looking at each half, I'm going to say that it's positive 1 if U2I was greater than or equal to 0. And it's minus 1 if U2i was less than a 0. There's some ambiguity about what to do when it's equal to 0, so I just choose positive. And this is the algorithm that we worked out over the summer. And so after we'd written a lot of the paper, this whole process is called spectral optimization, where you do the optimization using eigenvectors and eigenvalues of the associated matrix. We had to go through and actually test it, because it's not useful at all if it doesn't work. And so we ran it against the maximum modularity method. And it actually works pretty well. It's not as fast. Maximum modularity on a sparse matrix is about order n log n, so essentially linear. So that's actually really fast. Ours is n squared over log n, so it's not as fast. But it is better at finding complete graphs, because complete graphs have like the highest possible efficiency. Because we're not considering weighted networks. And that has a lot of applications in cryptography, where you can like embed a complete graph in another system, and the problem is to find it, which is an NP-complete problem. It also has applications in like traffic flow, where you know you really want traffic to be efficient. I don't know. What?
Insanely fast, Maggie.
Yeah. Sorry.
Thank. Where do I put this on, by the way?
I'll erase it, Dustin. Yeah.
Oh, it's okay. I can get it. These things historically run over pretty quick. Run over time, so. Hey, Dustin, do I put this here? Can I just put this in my pocket?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so today I'm going to be discussing a generalization of integer order calculus to non-integer order. So essentially, this is like taking like half derivatives, or say any kind of arbitrary real number between integer order derivatives or integer order integrals, and trying to figure out like what that means. So a couple of questions like I want to answer about this. Um, are, I guess, ubiquitous to most math things. And my buddy Rory back there told me that that in math you want to answer three things. And so, like, one thing is, like, I want to ask the question, what is it? It's like, what? It's like, what is it? It's like, what is a fractional derivative? Or, like, what is a, I mean, it sounds stupid, but it's really important to understand, like, the problem. The second thing is, I want to know how to compute it. And the third thing is, like, usefulness. So, like, what is it useful for? And so that's important, and that's a question mostly answered by physicists. And I'm not one of the, I'm not a physicist, so I'm not gonna go there. So the first thing I kind of want to do is start off with the limit definition of derivative and work my way to computing an nth order derivative, and then try to extend that to non-integer order stuff. So this is called the Grunewald-Lyotnikov derivative. So I'm going to start off just by using the limit definition of derivative. This should be familiar to most people who have had calculus, obviously. And so if I can just think about taking a second derivative, you know, I'm going to end up computing a second limit, but I'm going to use the original one. So I'm going to have, like, this embedded list of limits here. And then all of this is going to be divided by my original H2, this thing here. And so if I assume that H1 and H2 are converging synchronously, I can reduce this and just apply binomial theorem. So essentially, I'm going to group these terms here. Sorry if my handwriting is atrocious. And so I'm going to get the limit as just h tends to 0 of f of x plus 2h minus 2 f of x plus h minus f of x all over h squared. And so if I continue this process and keep playing this game and all of my h's do converge synchronously, then I can get an equation for the nth order derivative of x. This is precisely the limit as h tends to 0 of 1 over h to the n times the summation . So this is going to be my definition for the nth order derivative. And this thing in here, n choose m, is precisely defined as n factorial over m factorial times n minus m factorial. And so if I want to extend integer order calculus to non-integer order stuff, I need to be able to compute things like 2.5 factorial. So that's kind of confusing, and there's actually a function that does that, and it's called the gamma function. So I'm going to define the gamma function as such. So gamma of z is equal to the integral from 0 to infinity of e to the minus t, t to the z minus 1 dt. And so something nice about the gamma function is that it's continuous for the real part of z is greater than 0. However, at negative integers, it blows up to infinity. So you have like poles there. So a nice property about the gamma function, and this can be seen by integrating by parts, is that gamma of z plus 1 is equal to gamma of z times z. And so we see that gamma of n plus 1, or like this is an integer, n, is equal to n times gamma of n, which is equal to n times n minus 1 factorial, and that's precisely n factorial. So this right here is my connection between the factorial function and the gamma function. So if I extend that to my original nth order derivative, I'll get precisely this stuff. So this seems kind of arbitrary where I pulled out these gamma functions from, but I'm just taking n here and I'm replacing that by alpha plus 1. So you can see that if you want. I'm trying to save time because I'm a slow writer. So as h tends to 0, this upper limit of summation tends to infinity. So I can just replace this by infinity. So this is actually the precise definition for the Grunewald-Lyatnikov derivative. And so maybe if I have some time at the end, I'll be able to compute something using it. It's kind of neat looking. So, but like, if I'm trying to extend integer order calculus to non-integer order stuff, I also have to think about the integral. So a natural question is, what happens when alpha is negative? Well, I kind of have to go back over here to n choose m, where n is negative. And that's kind of hard for me to like define, so I'm going to go ahead and work out what negative n choose m ends up being. So that's precisely negative n times negative n minus 1 times negative n minus 2 all the way out to negative n minus m plus 1. All over m factorial, I do believe. And so I can actually factor out a negative 1 to the m because I have m terms up here. So then this will collapse down to just n times n plus 1 times n plus 2 all the way out to n plus m minus 1 over n m factorial still. So that's precisely Yeah, that's what I want. So if I extend these factorial functions using the gamma function, these will be my binomial coefficients for the integral. So using gamma functions, I'm letting n be alpha plus 1, where alpha is not an integer, or it can be, but it's not really useful for it to be. So I'll get negative 1 to the m times m plus alpha. The 1's cancel over m factorial. And so my definition of derivative being up here, I'll just go ahead and write the definition for the integral over here. So this is the limit as h tends to 0. Sorry, I think I missed something right here. I should have had a factor of n minus 1 factorial, and that's gamma of alpha. So that's just this times f of x minus mh. And so this is precisely the definition for the integral. So when alpha is positive, negative alpha, it just represents integration, whereas just alpha represents derivation. So if I want an identity, and I certainly do if I want this thing to work, when alpha is 0, these two things should agree. We can check that that's true. But seeing as how like this stuff looks very taxing to compute, I'm not going to formally give you, I'm not going to give you the derivations of certain formulas for things. So I'm just going to go ahead and compute a couple of simple things. And then hopefully I'll be able to visualize what some fractional derivatives actually are, and then maybe have some time to talk about applications. So the formula for a half derivative of, or a derivative of order alpha with respect to x, of just x to the k, is just gamma of k plus 1 x to the k minus alpha over gamma of k plus 1 minus alpha. So if I were to ask, say, like, what's the half derivative of x? Well, my k would be 1 and my alpha would be 1/2. So let's just go ahead and compute that. So that's just going to be gamma of 2 over gamma of 3/2? Yeah. Wait. Yeah, gamma of 3/2 times x to the 1 minus 1/2. And so gamma of 2 is precisely 1 factorial, so that's just 1. And this right here is 2 over square root of pi x to the 1/2. And so like to check to see that these things agree with integer order calculus, if I take a second half derivative of this, I should get identity. I should just get 1. So that's kind of interesting. So I'm going to go ahead and do that. So a second half derivative of this stuff is going to be 2 over square root of pi gamma of 1/2 plus 1 over gamma of 1/2 minus 1/2 plus 1. So then I have x to the 1 half minus 1 half. This will give me 2 over the square root of pi times square root of pi over 2, which is just 1. And so it's kind of interesting. A lot of people have asked, what does this represent? And that was an open question for well over 300 years. And I think it started with Leibniz writing a letter to someone asking that question. And in the early 70s, there were lots of journals that had open questions in the back, or books written by people or authors who asked, is there a proper way to come up with a geometric representation of the half derivative? And that answer is maybe. it's kind of hard to understand it, because like, if my position function is just f of x, well, what does the half derivative represent? Like, is that velocity? The answer is not obvious, because the derivative is purely defined to be a local thing, whereas the integral has very global properties. It's not local. Likewise, like a half derivative or a fractional order derivative is not local. It actually depends on certain values of the function. So in this case, they kind of say that it has like peripheral vision. That's not very illustrative, but I don't know. I could kind of maybe do one for sine of x, and I think that's a little bit better. Show what happens when I take a half derivative. I'm going to use orange because I'm bored with white. So for sine of x, a derivative of order alpha is precisely sine of x plus alpha pi over 2. So like, let's think about, if I take the first derivative of sine of x, I get sine of x plus pi over 2. So when alpha is just 1, I get sine of x plus pi over 2. And there's a trig identity that says that's cosine of x. So at least that agrees. So one could kind of think of the first derivative of sine of x as being a phase shift of sine to the left by pi over 2 units. So that's kind of interesting. So if I were to do that, say, 4 times, and I take the fourth derivative using this method, I should get sine of x plus 4 pi over 2, which is, you know, sine of x plus 2 pi. And that's just sine of x still. So like, 4 derivatives would correspond to just shifting the graph of sine over by 2 pi units. I could think of just maybe doing a half derivative. Well, that's precisely sine of x plus pi over 4. So if I were to graph this thing, like, what is this doing to the sine function when I take a half derivative? Well, you know, I start off here. If this would be pi over 2, this would be pi. Well, when I take a half derivative, I'm just sliding this thing over. It's like I could think of just taking this point and translating it over here, and then starting my sine function here. Bear with me, this might look miserable. Like that. I'm sorry, I did that completely I translated the wrong way. So I could think of this as being something like that. So I guess I have maybe a minute left. This stuff is better defined using exponential functions. So if I have a function which has a power series representation as an expansion of sines and cosines, or in terms of like exponential functions, it's very intuitive to see that when I take a half derivative or something, it corresponds to like that sum shifting, or like the argument of all those parts shifting over by like pi over 4. So that's kind of interesting stuff. But like, insofar as applications are concerned, these things are typically used to model like acoustics within media, or within, or they're used to model things which have very difficult to analyze viscoelastic properties. So like, it's used in material science, and it's kind of interesting that some of these models actually correspond to the properties of the material much better than like regular integer order calculus would. So anything that has like an interface or a boundary component can perhaps be like expressed using fractional calculus. But because it's unintuitive, it's not really used in engineering so much yet. So yeah. Thanks for bearing with me there. Sure.
Do you know if this has any application to fractional differential equations?
Yeah, it certainly does. One could express solutions of fractional differential equations as you could think of applying methods from PDEs to fractional differential equations. Like if I can expand a function as a sum of like exponentials, those things are really nice and easy to solve. And there's actually, if you're interested, there are actually fractional differential equations that are derived, or at least motivated by, certain PDEs. It's like the first dimensional heat equation and wave equation from that is actually kind of neat to look at. And the solution method is very similar. So like you could think of like applying PDEs type analysis to the study of fractional calculus. Sorry. Here you go, Dean.
How do I use this? Okay. And can you hear me?
Dude, it just goes to the camera.
Okay. Okay, so what I'm going to prove is special cases of Fermat's last theorem, which says that for n greater than 2, x the n plus y the n equals z the n has no solutions other than where x equals 0, y equals 0, or z equals 0. So the solution for n equals 4 can be done using the infinite descent argument on z. And for n equals 3, we can do a similar thing on the Eisenstein integers, which is z augmented with rho, where rho is a root of unity. It's e to the 2 pi I over 3, which is minus 1 plus square root 3 over 2 I. Okay, so to prove it for n equals 4, we're going to show that if there's a least solution, we can find one less than the least and keep going down from there. Okay, so we'll start with the equations for x squared plus y squared equals z squared. So this is the Pythagorean triples, and we notice that if x and y are both odd, then z squared is got to be 2 mod 4. So x and y both have to be, one has to be even, one has to be odd. So we can say x is 0 mod 2, y equals 1 mod 2. Okay? So we can show this. We can find the general solutions by looking at rational points on the circle, on the unit circle. And we can actually get all of them by looking at points with rational slope through a specific point. So it turns out that the general solutions are x equals 2ab, y equals a squared minus b squared, and z equals a squared plus b squared, where a and b are of different parity and are integers. Okay, so now we can prove the solution for x to the 4 plus y to the 4 equals z to the 4. Not possible. So, okay. So if this has a solution, then so does x to the 4 plus y to the 4 equals z squared. So suppose we have the least possible solution. So then we have x... We have them of different parities, x and y of different parities, and z minimized. Okay, so then, based on this equation here, we have x squared equals 2ab, y squared equals a squared minus b squared, and z equals a squared plus b squared. So, we then notice that y squared has to be 3 modulo 4 since we're assuming that x, if a is 0 mod 2 and b is 1 mod 2. And in the other case, we have a is congruent to 1 mod 2, b congruent to 0 mod 2, in which case we get half x squared equals ab equals a c, where c equals 2, where b C equals B over 2, and where we have A and C relatively prime, since A and B are. So squares can't be congruent to 3 modulo 4, so this case is excluded. So we can then reduce this equation. Okay, so consider equals A squared minus B squared over here. Okay. And then we have A and D are both squares because we now have AC as a square here. Okay, so A equals D squared, B equals F, and C equals F squared, because they're both equal to this thing, which is a square. So then we have 2F squared plus Y squared equals D squared squared. Sorry. Okay. So then all of these numbers are relatively prime. So then we notice that these are all solutions to this. So we can say F equals 2 alpha beta y equals alpha squared minus beta squared, and d equals alpha squared plus beta squared. So since f squared is equal to c, we can then have f squared be alpha squared beta squared, so that alpha squared equals alpha squared. So we can let alpha squared equals R and beta squared equals, so we can let R equals alpha squared and M, and alpha equals R squared, beta equals S squared, so that we then have R to the 4 plus S to the 4 equals D squared, which is a smaller solution. I was going to do it for N equals 3, but I can't find my thing. Sorry. Okay. Sorry.
How much harder is it to prove it
for N equals for the 4 case?
Yeah.
That for the 4 case is actually easier than the 3 case. The 3 case was actually more interesting by. For the 3 case, you would still be using a similar type of argument, and you would also be doing arguments about unique factorization, considering a modulo rho minus 1, where rho is the extension, the factor used to extend the regular integers to the Eisenstein integers. So it would also be fairly simple. And you would do a similar argument, so it would not be that much more difficult. But okay.
Could the alpha squared be the 2?
Yeah.
Sorry.
It's actually something I forgot to mention. Thank you. Yeah. So if you guys.
Okay.
So.